Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Ben hadn't had a decent night's sleep in a month. So, during one of his restless nights, he booked a package trip abroad on Expedia. When he arrived at his beachside hotel, he discovered a miraculous bed slung between two trees and fell into the best sleep of his life. You were made to be rechargeable. We were made to package flights and hotels and hammocks for less. Expedia. Made to travel.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nigel Adderley, and in the early hours of Tuesday, the 23rd of January, these are our main stories. Southern Gaza residents say the city of Khan Yunis has seen one of its worst days of fighting since Israel's offensive began.
I was in the university staying there. In the evening, gunfire started, shelling and airstrikes from every direction. I couldn't move with my 9 children at all. I do not know where I should go.
The US and UK launch a fresh wave of strikes on Houthi rebels in Yemen in response to their attacks on shipping in the Red Sea. And
there is soot under my fingernails. This is what is left of the cultural heritage of my people. This is what we will never get back, and our descendants will never touch this history.
A devastating fire engulfs almost all of the artworks in the breakaway Republic of Abkhazia's National Gallery. Also in this podcast, why Moscow's invasion of Ukraine is hampering efforts to predict climate change. And ahead of this week's Oscar nominations, we hear who has been tipped for a Razzie Award for the worst films in the last year. Palestinians in southern Gaza say Israel's bombardment is the most intense they've experienced since the war began. Israeli forces expanded their offensive by entering the Al-Masawi district to the west of Khan Yunis for the first time. Israeli tanks were also filmed just 200 metres away from the Al-Qa'ir hospital in the area. A Gaza Health Ministry spokesman said Israeli forces stormed it and arrested medical staff. A second hospital is also reported to be under siege. The IDF hasn't commented. Mohammed Abduhalib's family has been displaced more than 7 times. He says nowhere is safe.
I was in the university staying there. In the evening, gunfire started, shelling and airstrikes from every direction. I couldn't move with my 9 children at all. There was a building inside that we all entered and stayed in until the morning. I left through the back door, and here I still don't know where I should go. I do not know where I should go.
Nibal Farsak is the Palestinian Red Crescent spokesperson. She is based in Ramallah in the West Bank. Rebecca Kesby asked her if she'd been able to get through to colleagues in southern Gaza and what they were telling her.
Yes, we managed to communicate with our team in Khan Yunis. The Palestine Red Crescent is extremely worried for the safety of our team working at Al Amal Hospital and the Palestine Red Crescent headquarters in Khan Yunis. The area is under intense bombing. It makes movement almost impossible. Our staff, volunteers, patients, the wounded, and thousands of displaced people who have been seeking shelter. No one can move in or go out. This includes our ambulance teams. They cannot reach people who have been wounded and cannot rescue those in dire situations because of the constant bombardment. This happened early this morning. It was completely besieged, and anyone who's trying to move in the area was being targeted. However, later our teams managed to take one of the routes, and they were able to evacuate a number of wounded and those who have been killed during this intense bombardments and shelling. The situation is extremely dire.
And is it possible to know if any of your staff are among those who've been arrested, or what happened to those staff? Because we don't have very many details on that, or why they were arrested.
None of our teams in Khan Yunis were arrested. However, up to this moment, five of our teams are still arrested. Up to this moment, they were arrested more than a month ago from Jabalia Emergency Medical Center. We have already lost eight colleagues since the beginning of the escalation.
Eight have been killed.
Yes, they were killed while they were on a duty trying to evacuate the wounded people. 29 others were injured. Many of our ambulances, at least 14, went out of service, along with 19 others had several damages due to direct attacks on our ambulances. Our hospital in Gaza City, Al-Quds Hospital, went out of service. And now we do have the same concern that Al-Amal Hospital might also be directly targeted and go out of service.
Nabal Farsak speaking to Rebecca Kesby from Ramallah in the West Bank. The US has announced sanctions on an Iraqi airline, Fly Baghdad, accusing it of giving assistance to Iran's Revolutionary Guards and Iran-linked militant groups. Here's our Arab Affairs editor, Sebastian Usher.
The US Treasury Department has accused Fly Baghdad of delivering weapons to Damascus Airport for the use of the Quds Force, the foreign arm of Iran's Revolutionary Guards and Iran-aligned groups in Syria. The department also claims the low-cost airline has transported Iraqi fighters in support of attacks by Iranian proxies on Israel. Since the war between Israel and Hamas erupted in October, Iranian-linked groups have mounted multiple attacks on Israeli and US targets across the region. Fly Baghdad, which operates a fleet of eight passenger planes, has denounced the sanctions, saying they're not based on any material or moral evidence.
Sebastian Usher. Officials in Washington say the US and UK forces have carried out another wave of strikes against Houthi rebels in Yemen. It's the latest action against the Iranian-backed group, which has been attacking commercial shipping in the Red Sea in response to Israel's war against Hamas. Reports from Yemen say there have been big explosions in the capital Sana'a, which is controlled by the Houthis. President Biden and the UK Prime Minister Rishi Sunak have been discussing the conflict on the phone. The White House said they reiterated their commitment to freedom of navigation and defending mariners from attack. And there will be much more on this story in our later edition of the Global News podcast. For the last 80 years or so, leading nuclear scientists have set what's been called the doomsday clock to mark how close they believe our planet is to global catastrophe. And Tuesday we'll see the update for 2024. The BBC has been given exclusive access to the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists in Chicago to find out how they assess the risks. Today, technologies like AI and climate change are included. But the greatest risk is nuclear war, as Jane Corbin has been finding out.
North Korea has threatened to detonate a hydrogen bomb over the Pacific.
President Putin has ordered Russia's strategic nuclear forces.
Every year there's a meeting to assess the risk of global catastrophe and set the doomsday clock. It's a metaphor of how close we are to nuclear Armageddon. A scary thought, but the scientists hope it will alert the public and pressure leaders to make the world a safer place. In 2023, the hands were set at 90 seconds to midnight, the closest they've ever been, in large part because of Russia's war in Ukraine. In Chicago, we've had exclusive access to the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists, meeting to discuss where to set the clock for this year. I met its president, Rachel Bronson.
This is a very dangerous time. We have moved from a period where nuclear weapons were considered unusable and a nuclear war unwinnable. We're seeming to move into a period of time where we're not so sure every major country, UK included, is investing in their nuclear arsenal.
But nevertheless, no nuclear weapon has been used for 70, 80 years. People would say, isn't this scaremongering? There's no way we're moving towards that again.
And they'd be wrong. People would be wrong to say there's no way we're moving towards that again.
Here in Scotland, the UK's nuclear deterrent is on constant alert. The warheads are placed on top of Trident ballistic missiles, housed inside one of four Vanguard submarines.
Nice to meet you, Fergal.
Fergal Dalton was a lieutenant commander who served on HMS Victorious. We can see Naval Base Clyde clearly from across the water.
So how does Britain's nuclear deterrent actually work? Well, there's four submarines, and one of them is always deployed. One's ready to take over, one's doing maintenance, one's maybe in refit. But there's always one out there at 15 minutes' notice to fire.
There's a heck of a lot at stake.
Yes, the whole point of the nuclear deterrent is that it's never actually fired. People say, oh, you know, it's a weapon system that would never be used. It's been used at the moment. The Vladimir Putins of this world know that it's out there, and they know that it's credible and that we could use it if needs be.
In 2021, the UK government announced that it's increasing the cap on the number of its warheads.
There are continuing tensions, not only around British nuclear weapons. Pentagon budget documents suggest that American ones may once again be based in Britain, provoking protests at RAF Lakenheath in Suffolk. Sophie Bolt from the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament is one of the protesters.
The world is in a far more dangerous situation precisely because of what's happening in Ukraine. So we feel adding more nuclear bombs to that situation is not going to make it safer.
And that report was compiled by Jane Corbin. Researchers are warning that the loss of scientific data from Russia's Arctic monitoring stations following the invasion of Ukraine is having consequences for correctly predicting climate change. Sasha Schlichter reports.
The Arctic holds glaciers, forests and carbon-rich frozen soils. They're all at risk of irreversible change, which would reverberate across the planet. Parts of the Arctic warm four times faster than the rest of the Earth. So Arctic monitoring stations are critical. Yet the flow of data stopped soon after Russia invaded Ukraine nearly 2 years ago. Russia represents almost half the Arctic landmass. Without Russian data, researchers aren't able to monitor permafrost thawing, shifts in biodiversity, or even greenhouse gas emissions. It means crucial factors, such as Siberia's vast taiga forest, will no longer be taken into account in real time, only as a projection. The warning is contained in a study published in the journal Nature Climate Change.
Sasha Schlichter. The UK Prime Minister Rishi Sunak's controversial plans to send some asylum seekers to Rwanda suffered a setback on Monday when the upper chamber, the House of Lords, voted to delay the treaty for the scheme. Our political correspondent Harry Varley has more details.
In order to understand what's happened, I think we need to just take a step back and remember last year, the Supreme Court here in the UK, which is the top court, ruled that the government's plan to send some asylum seekers who arrive in the UK on small boats to Rwanda was unlawful. And they said that because they thought that Rwanda was not safe. And in response to that, the government signed a treaty with Rwanda that added legal weight to a number of new measures that aimed to demonstrate that Rwanda was safe. And what the House of Lords have done here is say ratifying that treaty that was signed between the UK and Rwanda should be delayed until all the measures within it are actually in place. At the moment, it's saying that Rwanda will do X or Y, which includes things like establishing a monitoring committee to ensure complaints can be heard or ensuring that international judges are trained in Rwandan law. And what the House of Lords has said it has done is call on the government to delay ratifying the treaty until the measures in it are actually in place.
And could the government just ignore this?
Yes, essentially they can. This is an advisory motion from the House of Lords. Remember, that is the unelected chamber in the British Constitution. And so what the government can do, they will hear what the House of Lords have said, but they can ultimately just set out their reasons for why they disagree, and that will be the end of it. It is an advisory motion. It is not binding on the government.
Does it give an indication of the feeling maybe in the country as a whole about sending asylum seekers to Rwanda?
It certainly gives an idea as to the feeling in the House of Lords. And if you remember, the full Rwanda bill that sort of is paired up with this treaty, that bill is going to start being debated next week in the House of Lords. And what it gives us is an indication of the level of opposition that that bill is likely to face. And remember, of course, in the UK, there's going to be a general election at some point this year. And for Rishi Sunak, the Prime Minister, he will be concerned that if peers in the House of Lords delay this bill, then it puts a serious obstacle to his plan to getting flights to Rwanda off the ground before an election later this year.
Harry Farley. Still to come on the Global News Podcast.
Good morning. It's the Lord Kitchen.
Hold my head and saw the whole sky.
So where do you live?
Kitchen.
We speak to the director of Netflix's new dystopian sci-fi film, The Kitchen, set on a housing estate in London. A BBC investigation has found evidence that the United Arab Emirates hired American mercenaries to train Emirati officers to assassinate political enemies in Yemen. It's triggered a wave of killings that continues today and demonstrates the complex role that foreign powers are having in Yemen's civil war. Former US servicemen who work for the company, Spear Group Operations, have spoken to our reporter, Nawal Al-Maghafi.
In 2015, fighting in Yemen's civil war was on several fronts. The Iran-backed Houthis had taken over the capital Sana'a, and Al-Qaeda were gaining territory in the south. To tackle the rise in extremist groups, the United Arab Emirates in effect took charge of security in southern Yemen with the backing of the US. The BBC has seen evidence that between 2015 and 2020, the UAE paid a private company, Spear Operations Group, to carry out targeted killings in Yemen and to train Emiratis to carry out similar operations. But our investigation has found some of those targeted were social and political activists. Bara Sheban from the human rights organization Reprieve has been investigating assassinations in southern Yemen.
It was not until 2018 when we started to pinpoint that actually this is part of a systematic targeting policy. You have this chaotic situation where everyone can name anyone a terrorist and start going after them. These are extrajudicial killings. And the most important thing is that it's still happening until today.
In a statement, the UAE says the allegations against them are false. The BBC also approached the Spear Group's founder, Abraham Golan, but he didn't respond. The US State Department and Department of Defense declined to comment. A CIA spokesman said the idea it signed off on such activity was false.
Nawal Al-Maghafi. Pope Francis has called for the release of 8 people, including 6 nuns who were kidnapped on a bus in Haiti on Friday. Kidnappings are on the rise amid widespread gang violence in the Caribbean country, whose political, economic and health systems are in ruins. At the end of his weekly prayer at the Vatican on Sunday, the Pope said he prayed for social harmony in the nation and called on all parties to end the violence.
I heard with sorrow the news of the kidnapping in Haiti of a group of people, including 6 nuns. As I plead for their release, I pray for social harmony in the country and call on everyone to stop the violence that causes so much suffering to that dear people.
Gangs are now estimated to control up to 80% of the capital, Port-au-Prince, and are suspected of killing 4,000 people and kidnapping another 3,000 in just the last year. Nuala McGovern spoke to Bishop Pierre-André Dumas of Anse-Avor in Haiti.
The gangs want to create a situation of panic in the country. And then, you know, the church, we try to take care of the people because people need food. There is a humanitarian crisis in the country. So the sisters is a sign also there is no respect for anyone. Consecrated people, they gave their life and to take care of their children, and now they are victims of kidnapping. We know that the kidnappers, they contact some people from the family and they ask a lot of money that the church cannot have, the congregation doesn't have this money. There is no price about human being because human being is so precious for God. It's so precious for humanity. You cannot destroy human being. It's not a question of money. It's a question of to respect life of people, to respect the dignity of the people.
Do you have any idea of who the kidnappers might be?
We don't know exactly who did that, but there is a lot of confusion in the country and people want to make some revolution. At the same time, there is a lot of violence in the country. 20 people died last week and other people also has been wounded. So it's a very complicated situation. I think we have to put an end to this violent situation and to ask the leaders of the country to be conscious about what happened in the country. They have to take some serious decisions.
I believe I saw you say that you would offer yourself to swap your place with that of the nuns. Have I read that correctly?
Yes, and this is because for me, 6 women, they give their life to God. You can imagine all the sacrifices they are making every day in life. And then now some people, they decided to kidnap them. So they are women. I cannot accept and I prefer to offer myself. It's not a show if they see that. And as church, we can also not only talk, we can also give some signs, because myself, a 61 man and religious leader, and then I can do what I can. It's not a show to say that. I'm very sure if they accept, I will give them the proof that these women can come back to their families and their communities.
Bishop Pierre-André Dumas. Now to Spain. Online romance scams are all too frequent, as are their accompanying requests for money. In a small town near the capital, Madrid, it appears two sisters were seduced by such a scam, which has led to a series of tragic events, ending in the deaths of three people. Police have arrested a man who had been renting a room in their property. Our Madrid correspondent Guy Hedgeco told me more.
The victims were three siblings, Amelia, Angeles and Pepe Gutierrez Ayuso, in their late 60s and early 70s, who lived in the same house in this small town, which is just outside Madrid. These two sisters had fallen prey to this scam over the last few years, whereby they believed that they were in a long-distance relationship with, they thought, two US former military servicemen, who were supposedly in the United States, and they were sending money in large quantities. And that, we're told, is despite the fact that local people in the town were telling them that they believed this was a scam. However, Amelia and Angeles seemed to believe that it was a genuine relationship.
And how did the suspect get involved with them?
The suspect, this 43-year-old Pakistani man, had rented out a room in the home of the siblings for several months. And this seems to be partly because they needed the money. But also, when he was living with them, he has told police that they borrowed money from him in order to send that money on to these apparent scammers. The suspect claims that he lent them around 50,000 euros, and that would be around $55,000, and that they did not pay him the money back. There is another link in that he had already been convicted of assaulting one of the sisters last year with a hammer, and he spent 7 months in prison. He got out of prison slightly earlier than the sentence. It was a 2-year sentence.
And it's such a tragic tale. And has there been any talk that the police possibly should have done something to try and prevent him going near the siblings?
There was a restraining order on him as well, but it seems as if that restraining order was dropped or was not enforced. The issues surrounding his early release are being looked at, and I think the way that the police handled this is coming under scrutiny.
Guy Hedgeco. The authorities in the Georgian breakaway republic of Abkhazia say some 4,000 works of art, which had taken more than 60 years to collect, went up in flames in a fire which has devastated its national art gallery. From the Georgian capital, Tbilisi, our correspondent Rehan Dimitri has more details.
A video on social media showed intense flames inside the National Art Gallery. Investigators say an electrical short circuit may have started the fire yesterday. It spread quickly through the wooden building. The paintings destroyed included 300 works by the renowned artist and stage designer Alexander Shervashidze. The National Gallery's director, Suram Sakanya, said it was an irreparable loss for Abkhaz culture.
We've been gathering this collection since 1963, and it went up in flames in seconds. Such a tragedy for us here in Abkhazia.
The art had survived Abkhazia's civil war with Georgia in the 1990s. Local artists had long been demanding a more suitable location to store the collection. A video taken before the fire showed paintings stacked together in two cramped rooms without adequate protection. Russia, which supports Abkhazia militarily and financially, has promised to send specialists to Suhumi to help restore the 150 paintings rescued from the flames.
Rehan Dimitri. Set in an endangered social housing community in a near futuristic dystopian London, The Kitchen has just been released on Netflix. co-directed by the British Oscar-winning actor Daniel Kaluuya and Kivre Torares. It reflects on class, gentrification and a future dominated by grotesque housing inequality, exacerbated by private developers. The film follows the story of Izzy, played by Kane Williamson, who is trying to leave the area. But he meets Benji, the orphan son of his ex-girlfriend, and slowly steps up to take care of him. As the people of the kitchen fight back against the authorities' failure to provide essential services and the police who carry out armed raids and drone surveillance, Izzy is forced to choose between himself and the community.
Good morning. It's the Law Kitchen, live and direct.
I'm getting out of this place.
It's our home.
Saving myself.
So where do you live?
Kitchen.
My mum, she said, never loved her. But you would have loved me.
The Kitchen is a project that's been in the making for a decade, as the co-director Kivre Torares explained to Amal Rajan.
Yeah, we just wanted to make something. So essentially, there was three of us. There's me, Dan Kaluuya and Dan Emerson, the producer. We put in a few hundred pounds each to do a workshop in a day. Daniel had an outline, and then we just worked together with a bunch of different actors, a few of Daniel's friends, to kind of like start to build out the idea. And then from then, we then moved into a more formal sort of scripting process.
Must be incredibly satisfying seeing it on Netflix. I mean, it is a dystopian commentary. What is it about life today in some of these housing estates that you were trying to capture and satirise or comment on?
People talk about a lot about the idea of people getting pushed out, right? And then as you start to break that down, you'd be like, okay, if you keep getting pushed out further and further, what does that mean? And then actually what happens if you push that to the limits? And there's, you know, one community in one place that's just saying no and who's remaining to stay. So, yeah, it was really just an idea of, like, where home is, what it means to sort of lose your home, what it means to always be sort of moved around or never have some sort of set grounding.
That's a massive issue for huge numbers of communities in this country right now, isn't it? With social housing, huge numbers of people are concerned about. And it's a particular issue in social housing where a lot of people feel, frankly, forgotten by the state, don't they? They feel forgotten by programmes like this. They feel forgotten by kind of the public at large.
Yeah, for sure. For me, I do think there's, you know, people feel overlooked or feel like, you know, London is so much money in and around London. But then day to day, I don't think people feel how their space is all sort of like their value sometimes.
Ian Wright, the footballer, is in it. He makes his acting debut. A lot of critics have been very nice about it. He plays a DJ called Lord Kitchener?
Yeah, Lord Kitchener. So we based him, the name really.
There's a legendary Calypso DJ
called Lord
Kitchener.
The Calypso thing that came on the Windrush in the late 40s. That gave him the name, and then that just really naturally tied into the place being called The Kitchen. And then we really wanted to find the voice of The Kitchen. We wanted someone that sort of like really grounded everyone and really sort of settled everyone. And we looked into his history in his past, growing up in South London, a fellow South Londoner, and then really just felt that he was the right person.
Kibwe Tavare speaking to Amal Rajan. And staying with film, the nominations are out for the Golden Raspberry Awards, or Razzies, which for more than 40 years have been highlighting the biggest film flops of the year. As is tradition, they're announced the day before the Oscar nominations. And leading the way is the fourth Expendables film, while there are acting nominations for a couple of previous Oscar winners. Here's our entertainment correspondent, Colin Patterson.
Let's fly, baby!
With an all-star cast including Jason Statham and Sylvester Stallone, action film The Expendables 4 has the most Razzie nominations with 7, including Worst Picture, where it's up against the horror film Winnie the Pooh, Blood and Honey.
Pooh, Piglet, Eeyore. We were friends for many years.
There is also a Worst Actress nomination for Dame Helen Mirren in Shazam, Fury of the Gods.
I feel good about this. Me too.
And in Worst Actor, Russell Crowe for The Pope's Exorcist.
You have a problem with me. You talk to my boss.
The winners or losers will be announced the day before the Oscars on the 9th of March.
Colin Patterson, and you can read more about this year's Razzie's nominations online at bbc.com/news/entertainment. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X, formerly known as Twitter, @globalnewspod. This edition was mixed by Caroline Driscoll, and the producer was Emma Joseph. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Nigel Adderley. Until next time, goodbye.
With Dash Pass from DoorDash, get more to your door for less. Groceries, self-care, restaurants, and snacks. With no delivery fees and savings on every order. Dash that with Dash Pass from DoorDash. Start your 30-day free trial now. Terms and conditions apply.